Can everybody please take their seats so that we can get started?
Okay, welcome everybody. There's a quick announcement before we begin. If you've ordered a printed papers book and not yet collected it, please can you get it from the registration desk before the tea break? Okay, this session we are going to be having two presentations covering different aspects of short-term insurance risk. The presentations will be 20 minutes each, and then we'll have time for questions at the end of both presentations. Our first speakers are Carla Fasana and Matthew Eagle from Guy Carpenter, a reinsurance broking firm. Matthew has 20 years' experience in the reinsurance business and is head of GC Analytics for the international region. Carla is responsible for analytics in South Africa. They will discuss ways in which South African short-term insurers can determine their risk of hail losses and compare these methods to those underpinning the SAM standard formula. They'll also share some insights into the research that they have done regarding earthquake risk in South Africa. Welcome, Carla.
And Matthew.
Thanks, Nick. Suddenly realize I need to turn my phone off. Firstly, just apologies as an imposter, and you can see my handwritten name. Those who are hoping to meet Amit Palmer while he was out, be disappointed. You get me instead. Amit's fine. He just logistically, we decided he needed to be in London for some other important stuff going on at the moment. So I'm here, and Carl and I are going to take you through this presentation. And the other thing about the presentation is the titles often have to get sent in months in advance, and we got hail and quake in South Africa. What should you be worried about? So first of all, don't panic. You're not going to be scared out of your wits. We're not doing any simulations of events. But actually, we've gone a little bit off tack, but hopefully we'll give you some insights and some food for thought on how to look at some of these perils and how to understand some of the model outputs one might be looking at. The other thing is we had planned to have an interactive session with, I think some of you in sessions yesterday know there was going to be live questions, the ability for you to answer those questions on your pads. I gather due to some technical aspects that's been scrapped, but we have left the questions in our presentation. So we are going to ask for some participation just by way of show of hands from yourselves, and it might be quite tricky on seeing all the questions on the slides. But that's where we're going to kick off. And I'm going to just get away from this podium. This is quite a technical and sort of detailed start, but one of the things we commonly look at when we talk about catastrophe output, people talk about return periods. And what we've got on the right-hand side there is what we call an OEP curve and the current exceedance probability curve, which give us a loss estimate for various different return periods. And if you focus on a couple of points, this is, if you look at the numbers, a sort of low-frequency, high-severity kind of perils. So something like earthquake, where we don't get a lot of activity, but there's a potential for a big loss somewhere out there. But look at the terminology people often use to say the 1 in 100 year loss is 10 billion rand, or the 1 in 200 year loss is 50 billion rand. So I've put on four definitions on the left-hand side there, and I was going to ask you, which of those do you think is an accurate statement with regard to this OEP curve? So the first one is, we expect a loss of 50 billion rand every 200 years. Who thinks that's an accurate statement? Just put your hand up in the air. Okay, got actuaries in the room. The second one says the probability of a loss exceeding 50 billion rand in any one year is 0.5%. Who thinks that's an accurate statement? Okay, we're getting a fair group, sort of maybe about half of you. I can't see all the way down the far end. Third one is, well, we've observed two losses of 10 billion or above 10 billion rand in the last 100 years. So this curve must be wrong. Who thinks that's accurate? Okay. And the last one, on average, we would expect a loss to exceed 50 billion rand once every 200 years. On average, who thinks that's correct? All right. Excellent audience. Spot on. Actually, number two and number four in my mind are both correct statements. The important point is really these curves are talking about exceedance probabilities. So we talk about not the probability of a loss of 50 billion itself, but a loss of 50 billion or more, and it's on average. So in a 100-year period, we could have had no losses of 10 billion or more. We might have had two or more losses. But yeah, if you get two in 100 years and you're one in 100, you might start to think, is my model or is my curve still make sense? But it's not impossible. That was the point. The second one is a little bit more tricky, and I'm going to just focus on one point in this curve. So here we've got this idea of what do you do when you combine the OEP curves from different perils or from different regions. So we've got two OEP curves here where we've got earthquake loss from Gauteng region and earthquake loss from Cape Town region. And both of them have a 1 in 250 year loss of 30 billion. But you can see the 1 in 250 combined on the right-hand side is 35 billion. So my question is, does that mean there's some kind of correlation between Gauteng earthquake and Cape Town earthquake, some kind of clash? Who thinks yes, there is? And who thinks no, that doesn't tell me that? Okay, again, spot on. You know, people get this, and I've seen this with a lot of people in reinsurance-based senior management. You get that when you just combine independent perils, there is a probability. We're talking about the probability of either a Gauteng earthquake or a Cape Town earthquake exceeding a certain amount in 1 year. And obviously, both of them, most of you on that side of the room, both of them, 35 million, have a probability of 0.2%, 1 in 500 year of exceeding. If you add 0.2% and 0.2%, you get 0.4, which is a 1 in 250. And for those being really technical, yes, there is a small probability that could happen in the same year, and you would submit that that's going to be tiny. So the point of that introduction really is a lot of people, and clearly none of you have any issues with it, a lot of people do sometimes struggle with just understanding the concept of they get all these model output, they get these OEP curves, and want to make sure they understand what's going on. And so one of the gist of our presentation is to look at how do you understand the tail of the curve and how do we use scenarios to help inform us on that tail. And there's too much on the slide for you to take in, but one of the interesting things that your starting point is to take your model and start to drill down into what parts of the country, what parts of, what sort of size magnitude earthquakes are driving the loss. And this slide is from an EquiCat model, which we, most of you in this space will know, you know, overstates the frequency of losses, earthquake in South Africa. But what you see here across the top is the magnitude down the left-hand side is CRESPA zones, and highlighted in reds and orange are the magnitude earthquakes from their model, I should say, not from anyone's model, from their model, and the zones that are driving the average annual loss for earthquake. Maybe simpler to look at, if you look at what's driving the tail, so now we just look at events that at the 1 in 200 year or above, we start to see sort of reasonably small magnitude events, but in the Gauteng region, just because of the accumulation of exposures, can drive a big loss. Or maybe bigger events which can happen around about the Cape Town area, still a lot of exposure but potential for higher magnitude events. But it's a useful way to start understanding what's going on and what's driving tail of my risk. So another question, and this one, you know, not expected now to understand statistics and probability, this is just your gut feel. And maybe for some of you, maybe a pretty informed gut feel. How many earthquakes do you think have occurred in, let's say, about the last 200 years, which would cause an insured loss? And, right, there's some uncertainty in how people estimate that, but I'm giving a guide of 1 billion rand or more in South Africa. So current values. How many earthquakes have we got that give us an insured loss for the market of 1 billion rand or more? So who thinks... I'm going to start the order. I'm going to go at the bottom. Who thinks there aren't any? So none. Okay, very good. Who thinks maybe one? So they hedge their bets somewhere in the middle. Who thinks two? And who reckons three or more? Okay, I would say we almost had the distribution. It's on the three or more was probably a bit lower, but none, one or two. I thought you were all roughly in a similar numbers. Well, I'm not going to answer that yet. We'll go through. So the first one that most people will have heard about, or a number of you would have heard about, is, and probably the most destructive earthquake in recent times, was the earthquake in 1969, September, in this Tilbach Ceres area outside, or sort of down the Western Cape. Different interpretations of what the magnitude of that event was, but 6.3 is one of the estimates. We've done a bit of, there's a lot of text on the slide, trying to look at, well, what would that event be in today's values? There's a paper by Lander in 1970, talked about an economic loss of $24 million. Interestingly enough, we converted that to rands at the time of the event, and you got only 18 million rand. A dollar bought you 70 cents. Well, now, in today's money, that would be 343 million rand. So that's a bit of a difference in rates of exchange. We look to take that rand amount and index it to today's value. So house price index has been just over 10% per annum, and obviously I'm just using that as a proxy for rebuilding index. Retail price index has been a similar kind of range. And if we index the loss at 1969 to current values, we get something just over a billion rand. Point is, that's just indexing the values of the property. We've also had, obviously, increased population, increased number of buildings, both residential and commercial. Population's gone up about 2.4 times since then. So let's assume at least double the number of buildings. 1 billion would become 2 billion. So of the order of 2 billion rand or more. And actually, I say or more, if you look at CoreLogic, the company that bought Equicat, they had an estimate of economic loss of actually 75 million rand, so quite a lot higher than the Lander paper. And obviously, if you index for whatever that is, 46 years from a higher value, you get a much higher estimate. They estimate a current built environment, or let's say insured loss, of 5.5 billion for that event. So back to my previous question, well over a billion. There's quite a lot of uncertainty around that number. Not expecting you to be able to read the text, but you know, those who get copies. Many of you would have heard about the modified Macaulay intensity scale. There are other measures of earthquake intensity, like peak ground acceleration, which measures the shaking of the ground at the site. But the MMI scale is one of these observational scales that people can just say, well, I felt this kind of this experience in this area, and so you can, from that observational data, you can build up an idea of the footprint of the event. And generally, it's really only intensity 6 and above that you start to get damage, even to sort of poorly constructed buildings. But that's just a reference for you for these next couple of slides. One of the things we do is we can take footprints of historic events and overlay exposure over those events and estimate what kind of accumulation we might get. And here's a footprint from the USGS, United States Geological Service. And remember, damage is only really happening at sort of 5 and above, really even the orange, but let's take the yellows. You can see quite a small footprint of where the intensity was big enough to cause damage. Overall, we estimate about 414 billion rand of exposure across property, motor, and engineering within intensity 5 and above. And if we apply some damage factors from that, we estimate a loss of about 3.6 billion rand using that footprint. But if we use this footprint, which comes from the South African Council for Geosciences, very different footprint. Now, you aren't asking why they're so different. People use what are called attenuation relationships, ground motion predictor equations, to basically estimate from the magnitude of the earthquake what magnitude, what depth, how the energy dissipates out from the center, and estimate what kind of intensity. And people use different equations, plus maybe some of the observational data. Remember, the USGS do this around the world. I wouldn't say quick and dirty. They're a very reputable organization, but they get these footprints out quite quickly after the event. So this footprint's obviously built from people on the ground who are close to the action, as it were. But you can see a much bigger accumulation of exposure, $2.5 billion, and therefore a much bigger loss estimate of almost $12 billion. I don't want you to get caught up in the numbers. We're just trying to give you an idea of how you can start to use scenario modeling to start understanding what's going on in the tail of the curve. But you can see some pretty big differences there. So we've got some scenarios around that event, but what else has happened? So since then, we've got a table down the bottom left, and you see in this table, you know, recent events in 2013-14, but all pretty small, apart from the one near Klerksdorp, 2014, which we think did generate a loss of about 300 million rand for the market. But not much. 1976 in Velkom, 5.5 magnitude. Probably, again, we think maybe something around a 200 million market loss. Big event in Mozambique, magnitude 7, but too far away to really cause much damage in South Africa. And another, the event I mentioned, in the 5.4 in Orkney, Klerksdorp region. So probably nothing on the scale of 1969 in terms of 1 billion losses or more. Remember, I asked you how many. So, but there's been some activity, and it gives us some information about the lower part of the curve. What about before 1969? And it gets harder because there's less data around, there's less information, and you have to take that into account. But there are a couple of events, and one in particular we know, 1809, also magnitude 6.3, and remember also that's a bit of an estimate, but happened near Milnerton, actually destroyed a farm, Milnerton Farm. It's on what's known as the Milnerton Fault, which runs through the region, actually runs about 8 kilometers from the Kuiberg nuclear power station, I'm told, so not too far. If that earthquake happened, I mean, that's a similar size to the Tilbach 1969, closer to Cape Town, probably a bit more accumulation. So we think that event's probably of that size magnitude. So again, more than 1 billion. Not much else, though. This one in 1932 near St. Lucia, which we estimate could be a few hundred million, but we don't think anywhere beyond 500. So it starts to give us some information. Maybe I need to go back here so I can see that last bullet point. What's going on in the tail? So, okay, 1809, I know it's just a bit more than 200 years, but I didn't want to be obvious and say how many events have happened in the last 200 and whatever that is, 7 years. But we reckon probably two events for the market that would generate losses of over $1 billion in that long-term period. There may be others that we're not that aware about, but that's pretty much the ones reported. But it does give us some information lower down, maybe over that 200-year period, about 5 above 200 million, but we know in the more recent time, 3 above that period. So 200 million, 3 events in 50 years, 1 in 17 on average, but there hasn't been much before 1969, so maybe 1 in 20, 1 in 25. I'm not going to say that gives you a model, but when you look at the validation of some of these model curves and things, you want to be able to think in this way, just to look at history and interpret it in a sort of intuitive, logical way. And finally, you know, we do then go into more depth, and there's, again, quite a bit of detail for those in front of the slides can probably see. On the top axis here, we've got magnitude, and on the bottom, on the y-axis, we've got the exceedance probability, so it's on a log scale. So this is 1 to 10 to the minus 2, which is basically 1 in 100. The black lines are basically some research from Professor Kiko and colleagues, University of Pretoria, so it's sort of up-to-date view on interpreting historic catalogs. This is just showing for the whole country. We drill down and do this by region because it does differ significantly by region. And the black line is effectively, there's two different black lines. Depends how you treat mining events, because there have been a lot of mining events generating frequency, but they don't tend to have the potential to generate very large magnitude events. And also there's uncertainty in what do you interpret as the maximum possible event in different regions. But that's sort of latest research. The blue dots are from our Guy Carpenter GCAT earthquake model. The red dots are from the RQE EquiCAT model. And what we look to do is to validate and check those models against the most up-to-date research And if we calibrate those rates, we can look at the impact of making those changes to the models using the frequencies of yellow. So here we're saying once every 10 years, somewhere in South Africa, magnitude 5.5 or bigger. So that's one component. Obviously, there are many other components. I talked about the attenuation relationship, and obviously there's the damage curve estimates as well. But that's just some insight into how one might look at the tail of the curve with regard to earthquake. Carla's going to give you another question to keep you focused and start to look beyond earthquake.
Okay, for the next question, we just wanted to gauge which perils you feel most threatened by in recent times. So if we look at the first one, it's drought. Yeah, we were expecting that one to be a bit higher over the last recent lack of rain. But then in the last few days, we lead to hail, which is number four, but we'll go with that one. Who feels threatened by hail? Earthquake? No one. And other weather perils, flood, wind, rain? We're expecting actually to see some people threatened by earthquakes, since that's what a lot of insurance companies base their reinsurance purchase on. They'll look at the, as Matthew's just gone through, the 1 in 200 or 1 in 250 year earthquake loss and buy their reinsurance up to that limit. What we actually wanted to speak about today is the effects of hail. Since we've seen in the most recent years is an upward trend of the number of hail events in South Africa. So if you look back to 30 years, you may say, okay, there's a bit of reporting bias, so you can't maybe trust those numbers. But in the last 10, 15 years, there's a definite upward trend in the number of hail events in South Africa. So the blue line shows all hail events, and that would be countrywide, while the red line shows hail events greater than intensity H4, which would be about the size of a squash ball. So the point to make here is that, yes, earthquake may drive your purchase in terms of the size of the event, but the frequency of the hail events may drive your sideways reinsurance cover, how many reinstatements you need to buy, since it will threaten your net book. Is there any other points you wanted to make there?
Yeah, that's fine.
This graph here shows that while a lot of catastrophe models estimate that your loss is a percentage of your insured value, this graph shows clearly that there's no clear correlation between the insured value and the size of your loss. So you'll see, for example, there's an 800,000 rand some insured value, but can lead to a 180,000 rand loss, which is quite a high percentage. So you shouldn't just look at a percentage of your insured value when you're looking at your estimated loss. These graphs here are just an example of a recent publication that we've brought out, showing the pre- and post-loss analysis of the explosion in the port in Tianjin in China. So it's just basically showing you that satellite imagery can help you estimate the loss pre- and the loss post-event. So if you look at the pre-event image, you can see your exposure in that port, and the post-loss imagery, all of these show post-loss imagery to show the estimated damage after the loss. So these would obviously show market loss, and you can, as a proxy, take your market share and apply that to the estimated market loss to get what you expect your loss to be. So in terms of hail events, we can take that. This is a satellite imagery of the Centurion station the Centurion Gautrain station. So if we look at an event, a hail event that hits the Centurion Gautrain station, you can look at this image to estimate the number of cars. And so if we estimate the number of 4,500 cars at the station with an estimated sum insured of 170,000 each, an estimated average claim of 30,000, that would lead to a total claim of 135 million just at the Centurion Gautrain station. And obviously the hailstorm would affect a much larger area, and this is just looking at the Gautrain station. So it's just an example to show you that you can use satellite imagery to do an analysis of the loss. Another scenario we can look at is a traffic jam on the N1 between Pretoria and Joburg during peak hour traffic. So if you look at this map over here, the red line shows the N1 highway. If we estimate an average of, how many cars did we say, sorry, 21,000 vehicles estimated, we can look at about a 640 million rand claim if the hail was to hit during peak hour traffic on the N1 highway. Then just looking at the SAM standard formula, the FSB uses a market factor of 0.446%, which would give you a 1 in 200 year hail event of 4.1 billion rand. Guy Coppens had recently created a hail model which would estimate that your 4.1 billion would be about a 1 in 15 year return period loss. Matthew will take you to the last question, Randall.
Thanks, Carla. I think just in terms of time, and we've got another presentation from Hannes to come, I won't take you through the question, and we'll maybe come back to this if we have time at the end. The point of this slide was really there are other perils out there that aren't natural hazard perils, and there's six potentials listed on there. I think the takeaway is that it's very hard to model some of these perils from a frequency probability point of view, but the use of scenarios is very common to look at how can you get a handle on the potential loss from something like terrorism, from dam burst, and various perils. So if we get time during questions, we can come back to that. But otherwise, thank you for your time and attention.
So, hello everyone. I'm going to be talking a little bit about risk visualization, touching on quite a few of the topics that Carla and Matthew, Mr. Eagle, has touched on. And just by way of introduction, when you think of a visualization, obviously there's like the cliche of a picture's worth a thousand words. And I'll be taking kind of maybe through the pictures or through the imagery that I'll show you, it'll be a bit more like a short story, because I'll just be focusing on visual techniques. But I think what we're trying to do through visual tools is obviously improve our understanding, but also improve the understanding of those we communicate our results to. So it's hopefully we get 1,000 insights out of the visual tools that's there. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I think when we look at the way that risks are being assessed currently in the insurance market, kind of referring to the commercial market, you might have an underwriter be presented with an account of 100, maybe 100 or 1,000 properties, and it's almost the way that the market rates it. You'd almost assume they don't have access to more information. Where you look at one or two key locations, you'll look at the occupancy or what actually happens in there, is it the manufacturing type risk, and extrapolate that to the rest of the book. So it's as if you're saying, one property is the same as the other. It's like you look at every tree is the same, every road's the same. But what you actually see if you start looking at different dimensions or zooming in and out through the use of certain visual tools, you start getting appreciation of the risk environment. So a road, if you any old road, this specific road is probably one of the most probably famous roads, which is the one that goes up the Alpe d'Huez. It's a kind of a road where many epic cycling battles have been fought. But it's also a very dangerous road, so you kind of see gruesome pictures of coaches with travelers going up there, and also cyclists coming down, and because it's open road at silly speeds, having an impact. And actually when I was reading through the kind of the duels that go up the Alpe d'Huez, I was kind of reminded of, how a bit of insurance markets, keeping your eyes on the competition, not necessarily suspecting anyone of drug use, but But actually, understanding that we're at that tipping point where traditional methods kind of, you know, might go up, is kind of starting to go out of fashion, where risk visualization tools, the way underwriters assess things, start using the GIS technology that's actually there for them. Talking about going out of fashion, I think in South Africa the trend about, you know, everyone kind of getting off the road bike and onto the mountain bikes, but not what I really want to talk about. What I actually want to talk about is the trees there in the background. Now, the first kind of story is about this nature reserve in Cape Town, which is this picture was taken in 2006, with going back with Google Maps, and this was it's a 9,000 hectare reserve with about 5,000 hectare of pine, commercial pine plantations. Not sure who the insurer was on this 10 years ago, hopefully not one of you, because what's happened 10 years on is this. So there's been a couple of fires. The first one pretty much wiped out the kind of the bottom right and section of the reserve. The second one, which was this year, pretty much wiped out the other combined about 60% of the reserve being wiped out. If you actually just go across the hill, across the mountain to the other side, there's another quite successful plantation that's also had fires, but all of those fires that they've been able to stop and actually not, it hasn't actually done much damage. So somehow they've managed to contain it, and half of it's been harvested, so not burned down. So what is that? If we zoom out a bit and we actually look at what it is, just to do through the use of kind of free software online, you can see that the first fire started on the bottom right-hand corner, actually across the mountain from Lawrenceford. And it spread, and where that arrow is pretty much skipped over the mountain. The second fire started at the bottom of the hill, kind of burnt up in the reserve, and was completely under control on 10 o'clock that night when the southeaster started gusting at, you know, 50 miles an hour. And within a couple of hours, actually, all the plantations that pretty much burned down took fire, and it threatened, it pretty much the fire came down all the way, and maybe a kilometer from where I stay, went around the mountain and actually was pretty close to doing damage to the residential areas. Pretty much most of the farms in the valley was evacuated. So what's interesting on the other side of the mountain is the wind and the topography. The fire that came across the mountain, they've been able to stop because fire don't burn that successfully downhill. And the one that came around the mountain wasn't actually been helped by the prevailing conditions. So kind of saying all that, I think it's just quite interesting to note how just through GIS technology, we can understand our risk a lot better. And maybe you would, if you were from an underwriting perspective and you knew that there's prevailing winds and all this risk, you might not charge the same rate in the Yonkerzoek Valley that you will on the Eden side. Just something to think about. The other pictures, actually, we talk about the change in exposure. So the previous presentation was talking about the changes in exposure that actually affect the insurance value or the claim of those insurance values from the same events. So this is kind of a well-known RDP development just outside of Sandton. From kind of this level of zoom or detail, pretty much looks very, it doesn't look like much has changed. We'll kind of zoom in a bit more. You can see that on the left-hand bottom, that's kind of 10 years ago, and the way the infrastructure is designed is pretty much for a family of five with one toilet, a little bit of land around their house where they can have agricultural, you know, maybe put some plants, maybe grow some crops. The one on the right is pretty much what it looks like at the moment, where there's about four to five families staying on per stand. And I think it's just whether that could be foreseen in terms of the way that it was designed, the infrastructure was designed with the open spaces. Maybe it could have been, if you just zoom out a bit and see where it's located, obviously, in terms of economic epicenter of Johannesburg and people, actually the ease of getting there, the ease of transport close to airports. So if you look at the current development similar developments maybe close to the area, the houses have been designed different, the infrastructure has been designed different. So, yeah, so it's just maybe through kind of understanding the locations and understanding the visual element or where you are, the location of where things are, kind of can give us insight into the design of infrastructure and the risk that's associated with that in terms of pollution, health, crime. This is another, just before I get on to kind of the perils or the things that actually impact insurers, this is kind of the Midrand, so similar kind of development over the last 10 years. The picture on the right shows the change, so it's just a study on urbanization and the change of surface water runoff from a kind of an unbuilt-up area to a fully developed area. And what we currently kind of look at in terms of our flood zones and what our return periods of a flood event would be in certain areas would look a lot different now than it did when a lot of these return periods was assessed. So something to consider. So just getting back to the property underwriting and the way that and maybe there's certain commercial or corporate underwriters that do things a bit more clever, but just from experience, you see, you know, underwriters extrapolating, looking at the total insured value for insurance purchases. You've got to put an MFL or EML on that, and you apply a rate, you get a price. And when you ask underwriters, they'll kind of say, you know, we do this by gut feel, we've got experience in the market. Well, if you think what risk you're actually assessing and the coverage is provided, fire, hail, earthquake, storm, theft, landslide, subsidence, I mean, it's quite a lot to stomach and just by gut feel. And then when you start thinking in terms of capital modeling, you want to assess the aggregate exposures across multiple accounts in the same area. So in terms of pricing, I think where companies are going is obviously cleaning that data, trying to geocode the data, asking the brokers for data. That's a good start. Where previously you'd get maybe the total insured values plus the top five locations. And once you've got that, then you actually have the tools to plot this out, to understand where the locations are, to understand your accumulations of locations. There's quite a few software providers. This specific program, there's a company called Grip down there where we stay that just let us kind of log in and look at these things, and I've taken some screenshots out of the software. But, you know, actually seeing where the concentrations of those exposures are, understanding the return periods, understanding whether that's within your capital modeling risk limits, and overlaying different risk metrics. So in this case, you know, just overlaying crime statistics of different areas on top of your exposures can actually give you an output or an estimate of possible, you know, at least give you a relative weighting for your pricing in terms of what you rate your theft rates at. Other overlays and structures or other kind of layers that can be applied is this is a map of the Dolomites kind of in and around Joburg and where your locations are relative to those Dolomites, which obviously impact your subsidence rates. We're currently, if you look at the rating manuals, you'd see underwriters charging kind of a, do you want subsidence cover? Yes. And unless there's a kind of a clear, you know, maybe your neighbor had some landslip or, you know, or, you know, it's kind of that assessment has been done on the same rate. So it is quite interesting when you see where the risks are relative to those risky areas. This is just a snapshot of the 2012 hail path and overlaying your exposures on that, similar to the earthquake risks, just by the visual tools that actually on offer to understand where your risk is and your exposure. Relative to those events and scenarios, as Carla and I have been talking about. So all that said, there's many different layers. As I said, there's many different coverages. You wouldn't necessarily want an underwriter for every risk to go on and plot the 500 properties, or you know, you might not have the time for that. But actually, bringing all that data together it's possible to derive profiles of risk, including various perils, to actually have relativities applied to your base rates for different perils in different regions. There's many kind of algorithms for doing that. There's many clustering techniques that's kind of available and that's described in detail online or in handbooks. But I think what this is sort of a picture of what you're trying to achieve in using the tools and the called layers that's available. So just talked a bit about the pricing. I'm going to leave you 5 minutes for questions, unfortunately. But the same thing with our capital modeling. We're generating thousands and, we're generating, hundreds of thousands of simulated records that based on a lot of analysis, analyzing the correlation between different perils, between different classes, between, data sets going back how many years, bringing catastrophe models, having all this kind of clever data that we generate, and what we give our business almost the top left-hand box is, this is the capital we need, and this is our mean from our model. Kind of plotted the actuarial utility function there at the bottom, which is kind of like the value at risk. You don't really care what happens below, you don't really care what happens above, but this is the number. So we've been kind of developing this is maybe the next step on first. Of what companies would start or what teams would start looking at. So maybe you'd start looking at the attritional losses for different classes, and you on the same page you start looking at the catastrophe losses impacting different accounts, and then maybe start seeing the diversified effect of writing these things together, and how capital will be allocated between different classes of business. You might give a graph like this to your management, which shows the distribution of profit at a certain percentile, which I think starts giving a lot more information. But other things through the use of visualization. So the top left is the plot of, say, simulations, the 5% simulations above and below your 99.5th percentile. And actually showing in a visual way the contribution of certain perils or risks to the simulations that drive the capital at that level. But from a business management perspective, you might not be that interested at the 1 in 200. You might be interested in what happens at the 1 in 4 or the 1 in 10. And then a similar graph can be, or similar kind of visual tool can be, or visual picture can be shown for the different simulations that actually impact different return periods, and what are the kind of the drivers or the key perils at different return periods facing the business. The picture on the right is, instead of just looking at capital allocation at a 99.5th percentile, you can look at specific, so similar to the picture on the top left, but actually showing where does certain perils actually start driving capital? Where does it actually what is actually driving our risk at different percentiles? And the next thing that management wanted to know, but what if? So we saw from the previous picture, it's the catastrophe risk for this class of business that's driving it. So what if we then put in a reinsurance, whatever we reduce our insurance retention, what happens then? And instead of going back and rerunning the whole model with that reinsurance retention, actually building a little overlay model or proxy model that just looks at the weighted simulations of within the limits that you're trying to test. So actually just looking at maybe at the 10% of simulations where the risks were, where the simulations were limited to those values. You could actually sit in within a meeting, actually have an engaging conversation and seeing how your kind of distribution graph changes, how your capital changes. Just leave you with this. So, I'm not sure, but I heard that in Chinese, the same word for risk and opportunity. This is just a picture coming back to the GIS of the in Selby, the drive-in that they've kind of started trying to extract more it's a mine dump pretty much that they've cleaned up. The improvement in techniques of mining, they're actually able to extract more gold and cleaning it up to such an extent that they do industrial development on those sites. So apparently part of the what they're trying to do is actually do this for most of the mine dumps around Johannesburg. Maybe a question is just what will that do? You know, how's our exposure going to change? Is it an opportunity? It's just great to kind of have these visual aids to start understanding our environment. Great. I think that's all I've got to say. So you can ask some questions, I think.
And then maybe I can ask Carla and Matthew just one question. You were speaking about your earthquake risk and the number of events over the last few years and saying how it's easier to detect or there's a lot more detection happening around earthquakes these days and that it's probably the upward trend maybe a little bit biased based on that. Would you not say that, or how do you see the hail risk being similarly affected by that? Maybe beforehand these hail events we were seeing happening, but in maybe outlying areas with no development or without social media and people sharing the pictures or insurance companies capturing that there were hail claims. So do you see some sort of a bias in the hail as well?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. One definitely has to take observational data into account. When we looked at the hail, clearly in those 30 years back, there may be underreporting of a number of events. We're not ascribing the uptick in that trend to any specific impact, whether that's climate change or other scenarios that may be impacting. But we have at least seen some uptick in the frequency over a period where we think the observational data is pretty robust. But yeah, you're right, there should definitely be some adjustment, or one needs to take that kind of thing into account. And clearly on things like earthquake, when people, and on other perils like windstorm, when people look at weather data or earthquake catalogues, there's a certain period going backwards where you're fairly comfortable that you're capturing all earthquakes above a certain magnitude or all wind speeds above a certain observational threshold. But, going further back, that's much less reliable. And our analysis on that 1809, there's a known event that we think could have generated, a big potential big loss in today's exposure. And we think if there were other big ones out there, there would be also anecdotal evidence to know that. But clearly we don't know about the frequency of smaller magnitude events going that far back. So when people build models, they definitely need to take that into account and adjust to try and make sure the frequency assumptions they're making within the models take that into account.
Any additional questions?
Just thank you very much for the presentations. Don't worry, Hannes, not one of you. I found it really interesting. Maybe to start off, just Matthew and Carla, for you. We didn't get to the last slide, but I mean, just looking at international events over the past week, the one thing that's not spoken often about is terrorism events. And maybe it's something we can have a bit of your thoughts on. Stuff that mulled through our minds is, obviously where we have masses of people in unison traveling together, the one that worries me, maybe because I use it often, is the Gautrain and a potential bombing on that, potential losses. But the other one that I picked up on your slide is a dam burst. And I'm not too sure how our population looks relative downstream to some of our major dams, but could you share some of your thoughts on terrorism and dam burst and whether that's something that should also keep us awake?
Yeah, thank you. Dam burst actually was on there for a reason, because a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, there was a dam burst in Brazil, which flooded a big mining operation, below the dam. And we're looking at an insurance loss of about $600 million, so 90 million rand. Now, that's actually, in the end, is really one individual large risk loss with a few small ones. And a huge part of that is business interruption. But I think it was just a reminder that regulators and rating agencies have put more pressure, and some of the unusual events we had around the world, the Thailand floods, the tsunami in Japan, a number of other scenarios, that people are trying to avoid surprises. And so you're right, we could do some analysis, and this is sort of a pointer from that to say, well, are there any significant accumulations in areas that where dam bursts could be an issue? The frequency is tricky, but at least one should look at those scenarios. And I think back to that frequency point and the terrorism question, it's very, in economic capital models, we're trying to basically look at probability of risk, and one wants to put some kind of curve, some kind of event loss table, whatever goes into the models. But clearly, that's difficult, and I think the scenario analysis helps underpin whether whatever curve one's putting into those models makes sense. And terrorism is definitely one where quite a lot of work has started to be done. Those tragic events in Paris last Friday, I mean, one of the attackers, it seems, was aiming to get inside the stadium and detonate the device. Clearly, when people look at personal accident books and life books, that's one of the scenarios that people look at, is what size bomb is a reasonable assumption within a stadium, what size of, how many lives might be impacted, and Caltrain would be another good scenario to look at. So that's one of the things there. It's a sort of average life impairment or life, cost and number of individuals. On terrorism, truck bombs, car bombs, people look at a certain size bomb. There's some engineering, there's some studies on how that energy would dissipate from the bomb and what impact that would have on buildings nearby. One of the things we are doing, we've done for a lot of the terrorism pools in Europe, is start to actually look at data, because when most of the terrorism scenarios that you can run at the moment just take energy in a circle out from the location of the blast and take a damage ratio as you move away from that. But actually what happens in physics and practice is the buildings themselves provide a shielding effect. So, the wave of the energy approaches the building, and actually then the buildings behind that actually get some form of protection. So people are starting to look at more sophisticated ways of getting proper PML assessments. And regulators ask you all to look at, and this is the same in Solvency II in Europe, ask you all to look at total accumulation within a 200-meter radius. Clearly, that's one of the scenarios that it doesn't have to be a terrorist attack, could be an explosion. The Tianjin port was just a chemical warehouse storage that went up. Actually, the firefighters made it worse because they went in not knowing what was in there and actually made the whole impact or the explosion far worse than it was going to be. But explosion 200 meters, and actually we learned quite a lot from that event of how damage ratio, what kind of damage you see as you move away from the blast. So you're absolutely right. There is quite a lot of stuff going on in terrorism, but some of those others are interesting to tackle in a similar way, like the dam burst scenario.
Maybe just one more question again on the reinsurance side or the damage assessment. There was a lot of talk a few years ago about acid mine water in Johannesburg and the impact that might have on severities for earthquake. But it's died down. Is that something that's still topical?
I missed the first part. The talk of?
Acid mine water, the water that's filling in the mine cavities under Johannesburg.
Not something I'm particularly familiar with.
No, it is still topical. There's still ongoing research on that. There was the research, there was an acid mine water working group looking at pollution and all the other impacts of the mine water. I think the most recent view is that with the kind of Rand water actually extracting the water from the mines, The only remaining risk really is the seismic risk. So this year, as I understand, there is a SAIA workshop that's actually got some experts in to look at the risk of the earthquake risk for acid mine water. I'm not sure what the status is, but it is still topical. I think it is the risk. I don't think the risk has gone away because it's gone quiet.
Just a point on the mining piece itself, not the acid, but the mining piece. When you look at historic catalogues, you can actually see higher frequency of earthquakes during the day. So it's quite clear the impact of mining activities and location on earthquake rates. But as I say, they tend to be, in terms of magnitude impact, slightly smaller than some of the other fault-driven quakes.
Okay.
Sorry, I've got a question here. Your hail curve showed an upward trend. Am I right that the number of hail events is increasing over the last 25 years in South Africa? So my question is, 20 years ago, is those events few because there were few hail events, or we just had less stations monitoring hail events?
Yeah, potentially both. We don't know if there's... I mean, there's not enough... The number of years of where it's really ticked up is probably not a long enough period. We could easily have a few years of higher frequency activity, and then it could drop back down to a longer run average. And clearly, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the amount of observational stations and focus on those kind of things could have been lower. So potentially both. We're just making a point of observational, and that frequency for hail is an issue. When you look at capital and earnings volatility and people set retention levels, as Carla said, have they got enough sideways protection on the reinsurance itself, but also how many retained losses net of your reinsurance might you expect in any one year? So it's just a point to say frequency on hail is probably more of an issue than severity. Severity is an issue, but from a reinsurance perspective, people are buying enough cover for earthquake PML, and therefore we think cover the worst case hail scenarios, so frequency becomes an issue. But you're right, reporting levels are important to take into account, and we may not see that trend continuing as we move forward.
Okay, I think we're out of time, so thank you to all our speakers.